Black Canary.
I'll need a sparring partner.
I'm Zatanna. Why do you care about some leggy dame in nylons? Or have I answered my own question? Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for magic.
Hello, and welcome back to Power of Fishnets, the Black Canary and Zatanna podcast, a proud part of the Fire and Water podcast network that was started as a way to discuss the DC superheroes Black Canary and Zatanna. Of course, I haven't actually talked about either of those characters in 2 years, and I haven't talked about Black Canary on the show since 2017. That changes now, however, as I am here to cover a Batman and Black Canary team-up from the Brave and the Bold 91. But as befits a team-up, I brought in a special guest to help me with the story. You know him as the co-host of Supermates, JLUcast, Superman Movie Minute, and my partner on Batman Nightcast. Please welcome Mr. Chris Franklin. What is up, man?
Man, this should be called Flowers and Cobwebs. What's going on around here? I mean, come on, dude.
Seriously, yeah.
Well, I guess it's the power of cobwebs. I'm sorry. That's how long it's been. I forgot what the title of the show was, you know.
You know what? You were my first guest on Flowers and Fishnets way back when. So, I'll explain this later, but it's fitting that you're here too for sort of alpha and omega type of effect. But anyway, I'll come back to that.
Okay.
Obviously, it didn't take a lot of arm twisting to convince Chris to come on and talk about a Batman story from The Brave and the Bold. But I do need to acknowledge that there is a bit of a pall over this particular story. Back in April of 2017, I had planned to cover all of Black Canary's appearances in The Brave and the Bold. I had guests lined up and committed for them. The original guest for this story was Zumyu Kanori. But a few days before we were scheduled to record, he had an accident. I don't remember the details. I think he fell and broke his good arm. So anyway, we tabled that recording, and then soon after that, Siskoid came to us with the idea for FW Team-Up, which kind of took some of the urgency and the excitement away for covering the Brave and the Bold appearances on Power of Fishnets. And then also, within just like a month or so of that, then, you know, my son was born right after that, so my whole world changed, and I stopped thinking about covering those stories. Then, as we know, Zoom passed away back in December, and for that and other reasons, I decided now is the time that I want to cover this story. So this will be a sort of tribute and a farewell to Zoom for me. And with all of that baggage and awareness now, thank you, Chris. Thank you very, very much for coming on to do this with me.
Well, I'm no Zumyu Kanori by any stretch of the imagination in any of the things that I do, but I will do my best to as a tribute to our pal Zoom.
I know that you can do a Solomon Grundy. You might have to bring some Terra Man to this episode. I'm just
I don't know about that, Professor. I don't know.
Hey, that was good. That was better. All right. Before we get into the story, was Brave and the Bold a regular title for you? Did you pick this up?
Oh yeah, like this issue's way before my time, of course. But I loved Brave and the Bold. I picked it up whenever I could. You know, I occasionally, if it was a guest star that I didn't particularly didn't know of or didn't grab me, I might not pick it up. But to me, it was another Batman comic, and it was a good way to meet new characters in the DC universe. I know, like, it's the first place I met characters like Adam Strange. You know, he pops in my head. I can see that cover. Or characters you didn't normally see teaming up with Batman, like Supergirl. And then once you got up into the early 80s, when I was really, like, you know, I could actually read. And and my mom wasn't, like, picking the comics out for me, basically. I loved Brave and the Bold. I mean, that run there. No offense to Bob Haney, who I love. But once they opened up the doors for, like, a rotating series of writers, although Mike W. Barr wrote a lot of them, I really, really enjoyed it. I mean, that's when you got several Alan Brennert stories. In fact, my favorite comic, single comic of all time, is a Brave and the Bold issue, Brave and the Bold number 182 with the Earth 2 Robin. So that's it. So, yeah, I love Brave and the Bold.
All right. Awesome. Okay, so let's get into this one. The Brave and the Bold issue 91 has a cover date of August/September 1970 and a cover price of 15 cents. The actual on-sale date, according to Mike's Amazing World, is June 25th, 1970. The cover, by Nick Carty, shows Batman and Black Canary lying unconscious near a flipped motorcycle as a mysterious man walks away down the highway carrying a smoking gun. A road sign looms huge over the hero saying, "You are entering Gotham. Welcome to Fun City." All right, what do you think of this?
I've always loved this cover. I mean, front and center is the beautiful drawing of Black Canary, because Nick Carty is, I mean, in my opinion, as far as beautiful women in comics go, there's Nick Carty and there's John Romita. Mm-hmm. And they're the tops. I mean, pretty much, I mean, you know. So, I mean, she looks great, but she's not overly sexualized. She's just pretty, you know, basically. She's unconscious, unfortunately. But, yeah, I've always really liked it. I like the layout. I think Carty was, you know, I think his layout skills are, you know, often overlooked, I think. But he was great at layout. Now, some of the covers he did for DC, Carmine Infantino actually roughed out the way he wanted the cover to look, and then Nick Carty would draw it. I don't know if that's the case here, but either way, it's a fantastic design. And in fact, I actually have a little excerpt on the layout of the cover from a book called Nick Carty Behind the Art by Carty himself and Eric Nolan Withington. It's a Tomorrow's book, which, you know, if it's a Tomorrow's book, you know it's good. And on this cover, Carty himself actually says, "The design of this cover is based around circles. You start at Black Canary's head and move to her feet, then Batman's hand, and you keep going around the back wheel of the motorcycle, down through the handlebars, through Batman's feet to Black Canary's arm, and back to her head. There are also circles in the background, the curve of the road, and the curve of the city light." So it's not just, I mean, he was thinking about, you know, actual design when he drew this cover. I thought that's fascinating. It was just like a cool, especially for me as somebody who once thought they, you know, might actually be a comic book artist. It's really cool to see that, you know, he really was thinking in shapes, which mm-hmm. is you don't think of, you know.
Yeah, and you definitely get that, like, sort of, it's not necessarily obvious until you think about it, but once, I mean, it's obvious there, everything from the curvature of the light over the Gotham skyline in the background, where that light is sort of coming from, but then the curvature of the road, the lines in the road, sort of like breaking it up and everything like that, going right between them, everything from like her curves and everything, and the wheel right in between them and everything. Yeah, I really like that too.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been kind of like astonished by like the sign too, like yeah. Fun City, is that's Gotham, like.
Is Gotham suddenly Vegas? I mean, you know, it's like, and it's so not the Gotham City of today, you know, where Gotham is this just urban cesspool, you know. I mean, it's like there's absolutely, I mean, I can't even imagine there's the Gotham of today, there's anything fun going on in Gotham. It's all just, you know, people getting mugged and, you know, drive-by shootings.
For the residents of Arkham Asylum and Blackgate Prison, sure. I can see that. Like, yeah, that might be a hell of a lot of fun for them, but yeah.
Right, that's pretty. They're the only people having fun in Gotham City.
In my dreams, the blood runs from my eyes.
Corpse for the Collector is written by Zany Bob Haney, which means, brace yourself, folks, this shit's about to get crazy. Nick Carty, the aforementioned Nick Carty, drew the book and Murray Boltonoff edited it. A low-level syndicate goon named Waxy Till is double-crossed during a handoff and thrown into the Gotham River. The murder is caught on film and reviewed later on by the leaders of the syndicate, who discuss the pros and cons of going to war with their rival, Boss Rhymer, over Waxy. The bosses want to hear from two other men at the meeting. The first is, the Batman? What? How?
Huh?
what appears to be the Dark Knight stands up and gives the mobsters the lowdown on what Batman and the cops will do if the syndicates go to war with another gang. The second character remains seated in the shadows, though he does reveal that the Batman is just another goon in disguise, there to offer the syndicate leaders an alternate perspective. The Mystery Man is known as the Collector, and his reputation for this kind of gangland political problem-solving is well known. Later that night, a police boat fishes Waxy's body out of the river. Batman confirms his identity to Commissioner Gordon, even though you'd think it would be the other way around. Private investigator Larry Lance snuck on the boat and tells Gordon that he was tailing Waxy for a client. Gordon erupts in anger, wanting to know who Larry's client is. Batman calms the commissioner down and tells Larry that Gordon is under a lot of pressure from the city to clean up the syndicate and the shadowy collector. Batman and Larry trade theories on the collector's secret identity and agree to work together to solve the mystery. Larry returns to his office where a stunning, raven-haired woman calling herself Myra Callan is waiting for him. She says she has a case for him, but it's all pretext, for this is, in fact, Dinah Drake, the Black Canary. She has recently arrived on this Earth, Earth 1, after joining the Justice League of America when a crossover battle on Earth 2, her original home, took the life of her beloved husband, the Larry Lance of that world. Of course, this Larry Lance knows none of that information, nor has he ever seen Dinah on this Earth or any other, and he doesn't take her seriously even after she throws herself at him and kisses him. While he appreciates the kiss, and could get used to more of it, he blows her off and says he's got a job to do. Dinah is willing to be patient, though, believing that once this Larry Lance can fill the void left by her dead husband, her life on Earth 1 can really begin. Later, at an illegal gambling den, Turk O'Hare, the man who murdered Waxy, is shooting craps. When his number comes up big, the croupier announces that Turk has actually lost, because the croupier is actually the Collector. He shoots Turk with a gun disguised in the rake and takes off with the money. Batman, who had followed Turk to the casino, tries to apprehend the Collector. The mysterious criminal opens fire to keep Batman at bay and escapes through a locked door. Batman sees what he believes to be the Collector running past a glass door. The detective hurls himself through the glass and tackles his prey, but it turns out to be Larry Lance. Larry was supposed to rendezvous with Batman earlier, but tells him he was delayed because of a woman. While canvassing the area, Larry finds a suit jacket, wig, and mustache disguise left by the Collector. Batman briefly considers whether Larry Lance could be the Collector, but dismisses that theory. Then, Larry introduces Batman to his new girl, Myra, who Batman instantly recognizes as Dinah Drake. When they're alone, Dinah confirms for the Batman that she wants to connect with this Earth's Larry the way she had with her late husband. Batman warns her that this Larry Lance isn't like the man she loved on Earth 2, and says this Larry will break her heart, but Dinah won't listen. After they separate, Batman walks over to a newsstand when he sees a flash of light from a rooftop across the street. A truck speeds by, dumping the stack of newspapers on the street next to Batman. Suddenly, a high-pitched noise fills the air, and the stack of papers is pushed away seconds before it explodes. Batman figures the bomb hidden in the paper stack was meant for him, meaning the light from the rooftop was to finger him as the target. But what of that mysterious noise that propelled the bomb safely away? Chalk that up to the Black Canary's sonic scream as she rides up on her motorcycle to make sure Batman is okay. She spotted the suspicious truck driver because of his gloves. She tells Batman he can repay her for the save by not disrupting her plan to marry Larry again, and drives off to see the private eye. The next day, Batman is briefing Commissioner Gordon when he gets a call from Larry. Larry says the Collector is meeting with his client at the sculpture garden of the Gotham Museum. When Batman arrives, he is nearly picked off by a sniper. Before he can tackle the shooter, though, Larry kills him, claiming he was doing it to save Batman. But Batman is even more suspicious now than ever, wondering if Larry or his shadowy client could be the Collector. When Gordon tells him that Larry's prime suspect has been dead for weeks, Batman is more convinced that Larry is involved. He confronts Dinah with his suspicions, but she doesn't want to hear it, doesn't want to believe it. Larry overhears this conversation and, after Batman leaves, reveals to Dinah that now that he knows she is really the Black Canary, he realizes that he has been in love with her all along and they can spend their lives together in happiness, after she agrees to partner with him to take down the Collector. Batman has Gordon arrest all of the known syndicate players, hoping to smoke out the Collector. When Larry shows up at their trial, he turns over incriminating evidence against them. This leads Batman to doubt his earlier suspicions, and then Larry tells him that the Collector is meeting Boss Reimer at the track. When Batman arrives, he is knocked over by Black Canary riding a horse. Larry steps out of the shadows and draws his gun on Batman, finally admitting that he is the Collector after all. Black Canary throws herself in front of Batman, claiming that she only thought they were going to stun Batman so Larry could get the credit for busting the Collector on his own. She had no idea he was the Collector and this was all a trap for Batman. Larry tells her if she doesn't get out of the way, he'll kill her along with Batman. The Dark Knight kicks Black Canary out of the way and dodges the gunshot. He throws a batarang that disarms Larry, who then jumps on a horse and rides off. Black Canary jumps on her motorcycle and Batman gets on behind her. They ride off using Dinah's driving skills and Canary Cry to help them through the jump course. At last, they drive up close enough to the horse that Batman leaps from the Canary cycle and tackles Larry Lance into a nearby pond. Underwater, Larry attempts to stab Batman with a knife, but in their struggle, the blade ends up in himself. Batman drags Larry's lifeless body out of the water. Black Canary is brokenhearted that the man she loved on one Earth could be so evil on this one, and she's ashamed of herself for being a love-struck fool. She wonders if she'll ever be able to find a life on this world. Batman assures her that she will. Whew, okay, Chris, what did you think?
Well, you know, I had read this a while back. I hadn't read this. I don't think I ever got this until I got the big Brave and the Bold omnibus. I always liked the cover, but I never found the comic or saw it reprinted anywhere. So I had read it when I first got that book, but I had forgotten again when I got to it that when Larry showed up, I'm like, oh, wait a minute. Is Larry dead? Larry's probably dead yet, right? So I looked up to see when Larry died, and he died like a year before in Justice League of America number 74. So I thought Haney was once again making his own continuity. This is Earth B. But surprisingly, he's using Earth 2 continuity. I mean, it's like, I'm like, this is Bob Haney? What? You know, it's that part of it threw me. Now, other parts of it are very much Haney. Mm-hmm. But the fact that he is, like, actually using a story nugget from Earth 2, it blew my mind. I mean, this even kind of gives more motivation for Black Canary to actually migrate from Earth 2 to Earth 1. They never mentioned it that she would look for the doppelganger of Larry in Justice League, which was her home at this time, but it actually makes a lot of sense. And and this type of exploring the personal ramifications of parallel worlds, well, a lot of writers, I mean, even under editor Julius Schwartz, who basically co-created the concept of Earth 1 and Earth 2, they left it up to it was always the big picture stuff. This small personal stuff wasn't really explored until the 80s when you got Alan Brenner, like I said, in Brave and the Bold 182 and Detective Comics number 500. And then to a lesser extent, you know, like Mike W. Barr, he did the Batman Huntress team up. And things like that. The more personal side of Earth 2 wasn't explored. So, I mean, not only is Bob Haney doing an Earth 2-centric story, he's actually taken in a very interesting direction. So color me surprised.
Yeah, and I wonder how much of that was his own idea, or if there was some editorial push, or if Denny O'Neill suggested the plot or something like that, because O'Neill, I think, was responsible for bringing her over in those Justice League issues. 74 was when Larry died, and then 75 is her first appearance on her first real mission with the League, on Earth One, and her first sort of kind of partnership with the new look Green Arrow. And then really she was, I mean, that was her home, her only home for a couple of months, and then this issue, and then a few months later is when she, the Green Arrow, or Green Lantern Green Arrow started, and she became a semi-regular fixture on that. So that was all within 6 months to a year of each other. So yeah, I wonder if this was like just some dangling unresolved thing that Bob Haney was like, hey, I can do something with that, or if the editor Boltonoff, or if Denny O'Neill, somebody else suggested that this might be a way of kind of fixing, you know, Black Canary's here now, but, you know, there's this lingering question, what is she going to do about her previous life? Let's answer that question. So
yeah, yeah, it's kind of strange because both Boltonoff and Haney, and Earth B is partially named by fans because of Brave and the Bold, Bob Haney, and Murray Boltonoff. So it's like that's where these stories that don't quite fit in continuity take place. And Boltonoff, and I think even more so than Haney, kind of looked as the characters as literally they're kind of like corporate looks at characters nowadays. They're IPs. I'm going to team this IP with Batman and make the story work. So I can't see it coming from him. So I don't know where it come from. That's what's so surprising by it. You're right. It may have been Denny O'Neill. It may have been some inner office meeting that, you know, or somebody passed each other in the hallway and said, well, you know, Black Canary's, you know, husband died on Earth too. I don't know what planted the seed, but it just, at first I thought, okay, Larry Lance is going to be alive in this story, and Haney's never going to mention the fact that Black Canary came from Earth 2 and that Larry should be dead. That's where I thought we were going with this when we first saw him. And I'm like, oh, no, wait a minute. It's this story. And so, yeah, so again, color me very surprised.
All right. I mean, there are a lot of like little sort of minutiae and little details of the story that we can go through. But the big picture thing, I had, when I reread this, I was like, oh, God, this is kind of the reason why I haven't talked about Black Canary for 3 years. Because I had this plan, I was going to bring this podcast back, and I was going to do this, I was finally going to tackle all of her appearances in World's Finest. I reread them, I did this massive reread, I started blocking out like what I was going to do, how I was going to cover them. And I got really depressed in doing so, because when I first read them a number of years ago, I loved those stories. I loved that she was getting her own signature adventures and everything like that. But rereading them again more recently, I got so frustrated by the way she was handled. And maybe it's just like a new, more awareness, but I grew to absolutely loathe the Green Arrow and Black Canary relationship and their romance in these stories. It just seemed so unhealthy, so toxic. And it was so frustrating because it's like, yeah, she's getting her own adventures in these stories, but they were so repetitive. And every one, it felt like the story opens up with Dinah saying, you know, Ollie, go screw yourself. I'm not going to be handcuffed to you. I'm my own independent woman. I'm going to go do my own thing. And then she goes on her mission, and she gets captured or injured. And the second half of the story is Green Arrow has to save her. And at the end, they're back together, and she's like, oh, I can't stay away from you, you big lung. And she's giving him a kiss or something, and he's kind of like childishly teasing her or something. And I was like, screw you guys. I don't want to read these stories. I don't want to cover this type of story anymore. I'm so sick of this thing. This is not a Black Canary that I want to read. So we get to this story, and oh, God, like this sort of dialogue, the way she's just throwing herself at Larry's just, I mean, from an emotional standpoint, I understand that. She just lost her husband, and that's something that is never dealt with in Justice League. It's just completely forgotten about. So this is an appropriate thing to actually feel like, okay, how does she grieve? And what is the grieving process like if you can basically, like, I mean, imagine, like, your wife, if something happened to Cindy and you lost her or something, and then you move to a new city, and there's a woman who looks just like her, wouldn't you be driven crazy to, like, try and be with that and try to fix and salvage what you had lost and get your marriage back? Like, wouldn't you do that? So I get the emotional crisis that she's going through and her want to do that, but the fact that she just has to couch it and say things like, I'm a woman first and a superhero second, and the way she talks about Batman, I'm just like, oh my God, stop doing this. This is not like, this is not what you want to hear from your hero character and everything like that. And it's just like, you're putting a woman front and center, but you're not doing it in a sort of progressive feminist way. It's very retro, regressive. So, it's a frustrating story the way she is handled for most of the story. And that's, it was just, yeah.
Yeah, I totally get that. I had the same notes. It's unfortunate. I mean, like you said, the concept is very solid, and in fact, it's for the time period, like we said, it's unusual that they would go in this direction. But yeah, I mean, by modern eyes, it's really not a good showing. But you know, in Haney's somewhat defense, he was not sexist in that regard because he pretty much treated Plastic Man the same way. I mean, Plastic Man, only in Haney's stories, was homeless, was love-struck over this Ruby Ryder character that Haney introduced that kept showing up every time Plastic Man did. And I mean, you know, Max could tell you about this, obviously, on PlasticCast and his different shows he's guested on talking about Plastic Man. But, you know, it's kind of that same treatment, and it's like this weird notion. And he did that to Wildcat to a lesser extent, too. This weird notion that these characters are, despite the fact that they're appearing elsewhere in other books, especially Black Canary, there's this idea that they're, if you didn't know better, you'd say they're like semi-retired or something. Because Batman even says, that's not the, you know, the superheroine that, you're dishonoring the superheroine who once wore that costume or something. Like, basically, you know, it's like, well, she just had it on like 2 seconds ago, Batman, and she was just at the JLA satellite or whatever, you know, yesterday in it, you know. So it's like, but it's this weird idea that these characters are, it's like the guest star characters are, I mean, they really are like lesser characters than Batman, and Batman's got to like kind of coach them through their problems or something. That was kind of another strange aspect to Haney's Brave and the Bold. It's not like the characters met as equals. Mm-hmm. It's like they basically are got some kind of personal problem that Batman has to help them work through or something.
All right, so addressing the points of the story. So from the second scene, once we get into this meeting, I get the feeling like, you know, Haney was basically like, you know what would be crazy is having Batman lead this meeting of gangsters. Let's show that.
Yeah.
And you have him talking, and he seems to be, like right from when you listen to the way he speaks, just, you turn loose the muscle on Reimer, what happens? I and the police move in easy. The young new DA wants to be correct. It's like, he keeps saying, like, I and the police, like, he's kind of speaking clearly, but the grammar is a little bit off, so you're like, this is not Batman. This is, there's something wrong with this, of course. And then he takes off the mask, and it's like this, just, you know, kind of like Cro-Magnon-looking thug with, you know, those heavy shadows and everything. But
yeah, Haney drew, I mean, not Haney, Carty drew great thugs. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're just, yeah, they've all got distinctive faces. When we see Turk O'Hare later, mm-hmm. I mean, I was the same, like, when I was reading this again, I'm like, okay, what's Haney doing now? He's got a bat, and I thought the Batman impersonator would play more of a role in this. No, he just sits around. There's just some guy that's like, you know, he probably comes to the meeting. He's like, put the Batman costume on. He's like, oh man, I got to put it on again. Yeah, it's your job, man. Put on the freaking Batman costume. You know, he's like, oh god.
And again, why is that something that the gangsters need? It's like they can't think strategically unless they get somebody dressed up like Batman actually putting it for them. It's like, oh yeah, they're very visual learners. They need that.
Yeah.
That idea, it strikes me like there must have been, like if this hadn't been a Brave and the Bold, if this was just like a Batman or two, like that would have been a cover thing. That would have been a cover that was designed 3 months before the book was written. That's just Batman, like, sitting at a meeting table with this group of gangsters giving them advice. And it's like, all right, write a story around that concept.
Yeah, that sounds like a Frank Robbins Batman story, yeah, so.
When we're on the boats, Larry, you know, sneaks on, he has this thing, and Gordon freaks out and grabs him. A client, who, Lance, who? It's like, calm down, man.
Haney loved to put those like everybody always points out that the issue of Brave and the Bold that actually guest starred the Joker. That Jim Aparo drew after Jim Aparo became the regular artist. And the Batman's got the one panel where he just like, Joker, I will hunt you down and kill you like the mad dog that you are and all this, you know, and it's like his fist is all, and of course it's coming from Jim Aparo, so it looks like Batman's literally gonna, you know, come through the comic book and shake your lapels on your shirt, you know. So it's like Haney loved to have somebody in his stories like flip out, grab a hold of somebody. It's like a Lon Chaney Jr. movie, you know. It's like Lon Chaney Jr.'s got to manhandle somebody and throw them around in every movie appearance he's in.
When we get to Larry's office, I don't know why Dinah gives him a fake name, but she does, and she looks great. I mean, she's in like a civilian outfit. She's got like a white miniskirt, a red shirt, red blouse, and everything. She kind of seems like a grown-up Donna Troy.
Yeah,
maybe it's like the colors doing something.
Yeah, I had the same note. She looks like Cardi's Wonder Girl. And of course, you know, Nick Cardi was the artist that most people associate with Wonder Girl pre George Perez. Right, so
first Teen Titans run. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
And you're right. I never would have thought about it, but yeah, like him and Ramita, they come from like the same school, like those romance women and men type of like leading characters, or something like that style, and how simply beautifully sexy and vivacious they look. For like that pose that she's on the page when it's like a long vertical panel of her just like sitting there, you know, with her, you know, her rear end pointing to us, but she's turned at the waist and everything, so you get the profile and her finger at her lip and everything. It's great image.
Yeah. I mean, there's not a whole lot to say other than Cardi. You know, he actually, like, one of the first strips he drew in the Golden Age. I mean, Cardi went back to the Golden Age. He drew a strip called Lady Luck that was actually an offshoot from Will Eisner's Spirit. So, he knew how to draw women, like we said. And I mean, you know, honestly, when we've talked about that before, you know, the way he drew Wonder Girl, you know, honestly, nowadays you kind of look at it, it's like, how old is she supposed to be? Because you feel kind of bad because it's like, yeah, she's probably only supposed to be about 16 here. And that's if that. And it's like, that's kind of, But at the time, they didn't think that way. But she definitely looks like a slightly older version of Donna Troy. Yeah.
Then we get the scene with Turk O'Hare being murdered by the collector, which I like that he's got a gun in his little the gambling stick, the rake, or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nice little trick. And then just runs off just with two fistfuls of money. It's like, this guy seems like he would be more put together than that. This guy that nobody knows his identity, and he's just running off like this. And it leads to the running gunfight where he's shooting at Batman. Batman throws the, like pushes the slot machine into him and everything, and then throws the batarang that kind of nicks him, and then crashes through the window. And it's Larry. And this was the first, like, I remember the first time I was reading this, I was like, oh, they're going to make Larry the bad guy. That's a twist. Like, I knew it, like, instantly. I was like, oh, that's the twist. It's like, this isn't a mistaken identity. That is that Larry is the collector, obviously.
Right, yeah. They throw some more red herrings in the way, but yeah, that's right here. It's like, they're good. Because you know that, I mean, honestly, in the Brave and the Bold book, it didn't matter if we never, I mean, honestly, he could have had Black Canary and Larry getting married at the end of this story, and it wouldn't have mattered because, you know, he did things like give Batman a godson and Bruce Wayne a brother, and those things never came up again. So, but there was part of me like you, I was like, okay, this is the way this is going to go down. This is going to be that Larry is actually the collector. I will say that, you know, Haney's, I keep saying Haney instead of Cardi, Cardi's, artwork, the action and everything, it's very moody. I mean, it's not, Batman's not quite the creature of the night completely. His ears are still pretty short and his cape's not as long, but definitely using it, he's definitely more moody and evocative than, you know, and Neil Adams had already actually drawn a series of Brave and the Bold stories before this, which is where all that really began in this book, which had, you know, Julia Schwartz getting letters like, the only real Batman's over in the Brave and the Bold, which ticked him off. to the point where he had to ask, you know, Neil Adams, why the crap are all these kids writing in saying the only real Batman's the Brave and the Bold? And he's like, well, because I'm drawing Batman at night and he's in the shadows. And, you know, and so then he started getting hired by Julia Schwartz to draw Batman stories. But Carty's, you know, taking it, you know, he's pretty much running with that same notion. This is definitely not the 60s Adam West Batman. Mm-hmm. You know, this is not the Silver Age Batman. We're in a transition phase. As you and I know transition phases for Batman very well.
So, yeah, then Batman has a scene with Dinah that's just so frustrating. I'm not interested. I'm a woman first and a superhero in second. Sure. Moving on. So Batman goes to the street corner by the newsstand, and what he deduces later is the guy on the roof is flashing his light as a signal to the driver that the guy he wants to blow up is at the corner. It's a guy in a Batman costume. Why did you need another signal? Like, why couldn't the driver have just sussed that out?
Well, they're afraid they'd kill their guy, you know, that the guy at the meeting, that the Bat... It's like, yeah. Maybe it's just Tony out taking a walk or going to get a burger, you know? It's like, yeah. We don't want to kill Tony. We like Tony, but we want to kill the real Batman, you know?
Oh, man.
Yeah, I do love that panel with the explosion that's like, it's in the lower left-hand corner of page 12, and there's this blam, big sound effect, and all this yellow and red, and this little tiny figure of Batman, and the whole street's erupting. And
yeah.
I mean, it looks great. It's fantastic. I don't know if the original coloring in the original comic was that. I'm reading the DC Universe app version and the big Brave and the Bold omnibus version, but it looks fantastic. I love that. It's such a massive explosion. It probably should have killed Batman, no matter how close.
Seriously,
he was.
It looks like a volcanic eruption coming from the earth. Like, I don't think a little like pipe bomb or whatever in that stack of newspapers would have done that to the street. But
right.
Yeah. And the page after that with Batman running through the wreckage and everything, and we see Black Canary on her motorcycle, which I've always liked that she rides a motorcycle. She looks good on that.
Yeah, and Carty, one thing I really like about Carty and, you know, the way he draws women is she looks like an actual human, you know. she has human proportions. I mean, she's obviously very gorgeous, but she's, I mean, her body, her waist, her proportions, her legs, they all make human sense. You know, they're anatomically correct.
Yes. Yes. On page 14, when Batman is being shot at, I love the panel at the bottom with him like kind of leaping out. That does look more of like the moody atmosphere creature of the night with the cape spread out like the wings, and there's a heavier inking and shadows with him jumping out like that.
Yeah, that's probably some of the Adams influence, you know, coming through, like where he's taking Batman in that direction. That's probably because I know it in that book I got that I referenced earlier. He talks about like talking to Nick Carty, talking to Neil Adams in the hallway and things like that. So these guys did commiserate and stuff. So, you know, there's bound to be influence back and forth. So it makes sense.
Once we get back to Dinah's place, Batman is confronting her. She slaps him across the face. She says, I won't believe you. I lost everything on Earth, too. Now you want me to lose it all here, too? Want to know what I think? I think you're jealous. And then Batman leaves, and she throws herself onto the bed crying for Larry. And, of course, he was eavesdropping and hears all of that and basically tells her exactly what she wants to hear. And he uses that to manipulate her into working with him to help her take out Batman, even though she doesn't realize. So, the fact... I mean, again... I would be okay even like with her like being so emotionally wrapped up in wanting to save her marriage from the grave, basically save this version of Larry for herself, and just how that type of love and grief, when it's all mixed together, can make you do really dangerous, really selfish things. I think there's a lot of great story potential there, up to including like her having this sort of blind side to him and being duped by him. I think this could be a really good story. I just hate how weak it makes her look within this context. And part of it is just seeing her like that in more stories around this time, too. It's just more maybe a statement on the way a lot of otherwise strong female characters were treated in this era than it is necessarily a specific commentary on Black Canary. But
Yeah, I think it doesn't make it right, but I think it's more par for the course. Yeah. You know, and I mean, Bob Haney has, unfortunately, he's got the story where Batman's fighting Copperhead with Wonder Woman and Batgirl, where they're all of a sudden fighting over Batman's affections, and which is just the strangest, crazy story, which is a few years before this. And that is definitely it's like, oh, come on, Bob. Neither of those characters ever acted like that. But this actually reads like, I mean, these panels, other than Batman being in costume, could have came from a romance comic, you know. Yep. And especially as drawn by Nick Carty. But oddly enough, you know, she says Batman's jealous, and in a few months from now, in Justice League number 84, which was cover dated November 1970, Batman and Black Canary actually share a kiss. Mm-hmm. So there's a hint of some romance there between them. That was written by Robert Kaniger. So there was something in the air about, like, Batman and Black Canary, like, maybe potentially being an item, despite the fact that O'Neill had already kind of started to establish her and Ollie as an item. So, you know, I don't know. It's just weird that these two stories like came out around the same time, and they're both positing this idea that, well, maybe Batman does have interest in Black Canary beyond just being a team member and a friend, you know?
I mean, one of their later, you know, Brave and the Bold team ups, I mean, they wasted no time getting her tied to a chair in her underwear, and Batman is there to, like,
oh, yeah.
So there's the sexual chemistry there, and of course Frank Miller and Jim Lee had them going at it on the docks in one of their bastardized Batman stories. The All-Star Crap and Robin or something like that.
Right, yeah. Let's forget about that second one. That first one, that was a very formative comic, and
I think actually you were going to be my guest on that one. I think if I had ever actually gotten to that one, I think you were.
I think I asked for that one. Yeah, but yeah, the Black Canary as drawn by Dick Giordano, tied up in her underwear. It's like, and a 5-year-old me was like, "Why am I supposed to be reading this?"
Moving on to page 18, I love the top two panels. It's basically one image just divided into two panels, but we see like the layout of it is cool because he's got Gordon and Batman sort of in the same frame in the foreground leaning up against the car, but the background images are two distinct locations, so it makes sense that they're two panels. So I really love the construction of these two panels, how Gordon and Batman are talking to each other as if they're in the same location, while what's going on in the background is two different things, because we see the crooks being taken away and put in, like, paddy wagons and everything from, you know, warehouses and gambling dens and everything. But I just love that, you know, Gordon and Batman leaning up against the car. Batman's even got his elbow up on the back of the car. Like, he's really leaning back. Like, you know, I just think about, like, the modern conceit. Like, editors are saying, you know, Batman can never sit down. He's always got to be, like, grim and stern and statuesque, like a gargoyle. And this Batman, he's just chilling, just watching the cops take away their guys and everything with the siren lights backlighting them in red. It's really cool.
Yeah, I put a note in my notes to mention these panels too, because I just think it's really well constructed. But yeah, there's that whole, like, Batman is, I mean, we're still in Batman is basically a member of the police at this at this point, duly deputized agent of the law, like Adam West, and I mean, he's even sitting in the squad car later, you know, in the back with Gordon in the next panel. And I will say one thing: I think Haney doesn't get enough credit for bringing Gordon forward. He really used Commissioner Gordon a lot in these stories, not just the way other comic writers had used Gordon since 1939, where he's literally the guy that, you know, Batman and Robin rush into his office. He gives him the clue that the villain sent in, or sends him, you know, well, the, you know, there's a robbery at the so-and-so, or, you know, turns on the bat signal or picks up the hotline. This Gordon's actually like a gritty street cop, you know, in these stories. I mean, it's very noir, and I don't know if he hadn't done this here, if that notion would have caught on in the regular Batman books, because, I mean, again, Gordon was just the guy behind the desk, you know, that's basically, he was the guy in the chair more, you know, almost to a point. And, here he's out in the street. I mean, like we said, he's roughing Larry Lance up, and it's a portrayal that had to start somewhere. And I honestly think from maybe other people know better, but for me, just I've never seen anybody point that out, but it just occurred to me. I think it kind of started with Bob Haney.
When we get to the final reveal, the climax of the story, when they're at the track, Larry outs himself as the collector, and he has been the villain all along. And when Dinah sort of turns back and she's unwilling to sacrifice Batman when she confronts him, then he turns the gun on her directly, you know, showing that he doesn't love her, he was just using her. And at this point, we finally get the actual proper team-up of Batman and Black Canary that's promised on the cover. This is really, it's like two pages of them actually working together, and it's at the very end. Like, up to this point, this could have been a Batman and Larry Lance team-up. Once she kind of comes to her senses and snaps out of it, you know, Batman, like, saves her, and then when Larry's running away, she jumps back on her motorcycle, and Batman gets on behind her. She uses her scream to help propel the bike over one of the jumps, and then I love it on page 23 when they just barrel through, and the motorcycle just crashed through the fence. And then, yeah, Batman tackles him, they fight in the water, and we don't actually see it, but the knife goes in, and they have to pull his body out onto the grass. And Dinah is sad again.
Yeah.
What did you think of, like, the climactic fight?
I think maybe we could have swallowed the way Dinah was acting through the story if she had just used the canary cry on Larry on page 21, you know? Mm-hmm. And when he's got the gun pointed at her, she just blasts him. And then she apologized to Batman. I'm so sorry. I was so love-struck and blind I didn't see. Of course, then Larry would have been alive and in, you know, jail. But maybe that would have kind of been kind of a neat aspect for her to have this character that obviously she's attracted to still exist and maybe create trouble for her down the line, you know, you know, maybe trouble for her and Green Arrow or something. That would have been a more, you know, a braver or bolder choice to make for the character. But yeah, I mean, I do like all the motorcycle stuff of the fact that they do get to work together. Because like you said, if they hadn't done this, they would have never actually teamed up. So I guess in a way it works that way. But again, Batman's the one that gets to fight Larry. Of course, he obviously didn't want Larry to kill him, to die. But the thing with the horse at the end is kind of the horse, like, you know, nudges Canary. And it's kind of weird. And it's one of those, you know, laughs. It's Star Trek. Classic Star Trek endings where they have the little laugh at the end of the episode, even if it wasn't a funny episode, you know. So it's a little strange and out of place. It's a typical 60s, 70s TV show ending type thing, which I was just kind of like, you know, I kind of think I would have rather had, you know, Batman have his hand on her shoulder or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have much else to say. I'd like when Batman is teaming up with Black Canary, I love Brave and the Bold. And I think there was a lot of great potential to explore Dinah's grief over her husband, and especially when she comes to a new world that has a different version of that man, and wanting to connect with him and wanting to just, you know, erase the death and basically restart the same way, and having to come to terms with the fact that this version of her husband is a terrible person, that he's a criminal, he's the opposite of what she wanted, and her even her being kind of blinded to that by her grief and her love and everything like that, and being compromised emotionally, I think that's great fodder for story. I just hate how damsel in distress and you know, such a girl she is in the story, from a very kind of 60s, 70s version of that word. Yeah, so it's frustrating, but
yeah, there's aspects of it that I applaud. Like I said, I mean, just the, especially coming from Bob Haney, the fact that he took continuity and used it this time instead of ignoring it, you know, yeah. And rewriting his own. That's a pleasant surprise, but yeah, it unfortunately this kind of portrayal, you know, was pretty typical. I mean, you look at how I know it was brought up a lot over the course of the Fantastic Cast, just how the Invisible Woman, Invisible Girl, Sue Storm was portrayed, and it's really, in hindsight, it's really kind of hard to swallow in some ways now, you know. And this is a little bit more of that, and it's just, yeah, it's unfortunate. It's just from our modern eyes, it just seems wrong, and it seems wrong to wave your hand and say, well, that's the way it was back then. But I mean, honestly, that's the way the characters were portrayed back then. Doesn't make it right, but it's par for the course.
All right, well, thank you for being my guest on this episode. Thank you for helping me cover this one.
Chris, no problem. I enjoyed it.
Where else can people find you?
Well, you can find me on JLUcast. That's what I do, a show I do with my wife, Cindy, where we cover the Justice League and Justice League Unlimited, which will eventually feature Black Canary pretty prominently. But we're not there yet. We're just getting into season two, so you got to wait a season before we get there. Also, we do Supermates together occasionally, and Rob and I do Power Records, the Superman Movie Minute, and you and I do Batman Nightcast, and I'm elsewhere on the network here and there as well.
All right, folks, we're going to take a promo break here, but then I will be back with listener feedback from the previous episode and an important announcement. So stick around for that.
I am vengeance. I am the knight. I am Batman.
You need to take out the trash.
I don't have time for that now. We have two podcasts I have to create a new promo for.
What? Both JLUcast and Supermates?
Yes. JLUcast, where you and I discussed the Justice League and Justice League Unlimited animated series from Bruce Timm and company.
And Supermates, our original show where we talk about all sorts of geeky stuff, including our annual House of Frankenstein series on classic horror films. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's it. But how do we combine this into one promo?
I have no idea, but it sounds like we're doing our original Supermates promo all over again.
I kind of think we are, but hey, other folks kind of aped it, so it must have worked.
Well, why don't you get to work taking out the trash and I'll finish up.
Great.
So join us, Cindy.
And Chris.
On JLUcast and Supermates, both proudly part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, found at fireandwaterpodcast.com and on iTunes.
On the last episode of Power of Fishnets, the irredeemable Shag and I discussed the Marvel character Typhoid Mary and her twisted sexual and murderous relationships with Daredevil and the Kingpin. These are the comments we received on the Fire and Water website. The first comment came from Chris Franklin, who you just heard minutes ago. Chris said, "Great discussion, guys. I read this run from afar off a childhood buddy. I didn't care for John Romita Jr.'s evolving art style and didn't get Mary's hotness from the art, so I can't say the character grabbed me. But your discussion has intrigued me, and I would be down to reread it at close range with adult eyes. It seems like I met most of Daredevil's villains when Spider-Man borrowed them, such as the Owl, Stiltman, and Gladiator. It seems Peter Parker the Spectacular Spider-Man was moonlighting as a Daredevil comic in the early 80s. Maybe that was the exchange for Daredevil getting Kingpin? Free Willy, he's got to be worth at least 3 or 4 B to C level foes. How dare you refer to Stiltman as a B or C level?" Friend of the network David Gallagher, the writer of The Only Living Boy and The Only Living Girl, he chimed in with an image of his favorite Typhoid Mary action figure from the Toy Biz Vault line. I can't say I like that particular figure based on the picture that he sent. Nathaniel Wayne from Council of Geeks and the Tough Like a Girl podcast here on this network, he responded to Shag's praise for the Netflix Defenders show. Nathaniel said, "Don't listen to Shag. Do not watch the Defenders. It started out well, but by episode 6 it falls apart so spectacularly that I almost have to wonder if they screwed it up on purpose. Out of respect for spoilers, in case anybody hasn't watched it, don't. I can't get into specifics. What I will say is that the Hand are by far the worst creation of the MCU. They are the most incoherent villain group I can think of. Yes, even worse than the Dark Elves from the second Thor. And understand, I really liked Defenders through the fourth episode and was on board with it. But oh dear God, what a faceplant. As for Typhoid, really the only nod to the comic version in Iron Fist Season 2, which is better than Season 1, but then so was a swift kick to the Joy Department, is the multiple personality thing. And I know that's the major hook of the character, but it's not done in a comic book fashion. They try to ground it, and it just kind of makes her far less memorable than she is on the page. Speaking of the page, I have a hard time finding a look for her that pulls it all together for me. I've always liked the split face, and I prefer the more modern versions as far as the tamer hair goes, but most of her modern outfits have been with this leather jacket not zipped up with nothing on underneath it, so it just feels kind of gross that way. I think my ideal would be the modern straight hair on the original outfit, minus the shoulder pads. Yeah, I mean, I kind of, for me, I have a hard time not thinking of her with the big 80s hair, but yeah, I mean, I definitely like the kind of like the ripped up shirt look and the fishnets from the classic version. The Hot Topic versions of the, like, sex pot versions from the newer images of Typhoid Mary, they don't do a whole lot for me. I don't think that's very interesting, so I like the old school. Siskoid from Oh Hotmu or Not and many other shows here on the network said, Daredevil is also one of my very favorite Marvel characters. I read the Miller and O'Neill stuff borrowed from a friend and started buying it for myself in the Nocenti run, probably because of Inferno, but I stayed through the end of her stint. Loved it. Came back to it for Kiesel briefly, and the recent Mark Waid series was definitely my jam. I am also a defender of the Ben Affleck movie, both cuts for different reasons, so I'm very much with Shag on all of this, at least until he makes the outrageous faux pas of saying the Defenders was good. Iron Fist dragged it down, and personally, enough with the hand. The better Marvel Netflix shows were Jessica Jones, Luke Cage, and Punisher. So far, that's two votes saying the Defenders was awful. All I can say is that I watched the first episode and I thought it was boring, so I'm not really inclined to check it out, knowing that everybody thinks that the ending is awful. Brian Linton said, Man, this episode really brought me back to my comic book collecting roots. Daredevil was one of the first, if not the first, title I collected regularly, and this Typhoid Mary story was my jumping on point. As a result, like Shag, Nocenti will always be at the top of my list of Daredevil writers. As an aside, Silver Surfer was the other title I first collected on a regular basis. I previously hypothesized that I must have been into philosophical brooding heroes back then, but thanks to Ryan, I now realize that I was just drawn to the monochromatic superheroes. I wonder if that could be the basis for a new podcast. Absolutely, yeah. Stick to the monochromatic heroes. You got Daredevil, Silver Surfer, Black Panther. I'm sure plenty of others you could throw in, but yeah. Lizanne Oswalt said, I remember picking these issues off the stands. They were good. I like Typhoid Mary. She was even good as a hero in Marvel Comics Presents when she teamed with Vengeance. The costume wasn't as good, but it worked. Her run in Daredevil was great, as was her weird relationship with Kingpin. Wonder when she'll appear next. And finally, Diablo Frank from the Rolled Spine podcast said, Elektra was before my time on Daredevil, and Typhoid Mary was partially after. Inexplicably, despite my affection for John Romita Jr. in general and for early Ann Nocenti, something about the combination of the two turned me off of the book. However, I was immediately drawn to Typhoid and picked up some of her initial appearances off the newsstand. I agree with Nathaniel Wayne that John Romita Jr. just wasn't the right artist for the concept, but Steve Lytle certainly was, and Typhoid's appearances in Marvel Comics Presents were some of the only Marvel books I reliably picked up at the time, as well as the crap John Van Fleet miniseries and her unwelcome arc in Spectacular Spider-Man. My last attempt to give a fig about the character was the typically useless handling by Bendis in the Hardcore arc, though I did buy the Typhoid's Kiss trade that collected all of the non-Daredevil material I just referenced, and then some. Alright, that is a wrap for the listener feedback section, and it is also a wrap for this podcast. Not just this episode, I mean Power of Fishnets. This is the final episode. I am retiring the show. As I mentioned to Chris at the beginning, I haven't talked about Black Canary or Zatanna on the show in years, and I don't see that changing anytime soon. I just don't have the same love for these characters or the same drive to talk about them that I used to. I feel really good about what I accomplished with Zatanna. I covered her story from her first appearance all the way up until she joined the Justice League and changed her costume. That was the stated mission for Zatanna, and I accomplished that, so I am content. Yes, she did make other appearances in Fishnets throughout the years, and there was the whole Paul Dini series from about 10 years ago. Maybe someday I will want to talk about those. If I do, they will be on FW Presents. In fact, I already know there is one specific Zatanna story that I am going to discuss on a Find Your Joy episode coming soon. But other than that, I don't have anything else to say about her. And as for Black Canary, you heard what I said. I am so frustrated with her right now. A lot of my drive for this podcast was building to covering her appearances in World's Finest, and I reread those issues last year, and they depressed the hell out of me. I hate how she was depicted. I hate her relationship with Oliver in those stories. Theirs is possibly my least favorite relationship in all of comics. It's awful. Yes, Black Canary has other, better, stronger appearances in comics like Justice League of America and Birds of Prey, and there are other podcasts for that. Check her out on those shows. I don't have anything more to say about her solo adventures. I also, frankly, I kind of want to bail out on this character now because she's getting a ton of exposure in live action, but it's not any version of Black Canary that I like or recognize. There have been 3 or 4 Canaries in the CW universe, I think. They're starting a new show called Green Arrow and the Canaries next year. Like, what? And then there's the Birds of Prey movie, which to me looks pretty awful, because it looks like Harley Quinn, who I hated in the Suicide Squad movie, partnering with 3 women who have no identifiable personalities or signature costumes, at least not from the trailers I've seen. And the Black Canary in the movie looks nothing like the Canary I love. Diablo Frank talked about this on one of his shows. It's not that they changed the race of the character, because I don't have a problem with that on the whole. And the actress that they cast looks beautiful and tough, and she might be really impressive. But Black Canary's look is very specific. The blonde wig, the old-fashioned costume, the fact that she's supposed to kind of look like an old 40s or 50s movie starlet. These are as crucial to her look as Batman's cape and cowl. If you mess with the most basic, iconic, identifiable part of the character, you lose what makes the character worth looking at. I've never liked any of Dinah's other costumes, so if you're changing that much about her, I don't want to follow you there. And the movie might be super popular and successful, and Black Canary might be a new fan favorite, and girls might want to dress as her for Halloween, and there might be a whole new slew of fans of the CW Canaries. I just don't want to get caught up in that wave because I don't feel part of it. So, yeah, this is me bidding farewell to the fishnets. I've had a great time discussing Black Canary and Zatanna on these episodes. It was a ton of fun. But going forward, I can't see it being fun anymore, which means it's time to bail. So, thank you everybody who supported this podcast up until now. Your comments, your likes, shares, favorites, retweets, reviews, all of it was great. I hope you all enjoy my next fetish show, Feathers and Females, a Hawk Girl and Dawnstar podcast, coming soon. Power of Fishnets was a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Feedback for this show can be left at fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can also find me on Twitter at RyanDaily01, or you can send an email to rdailypodcast@gmail.com. You can also support the Fire and Water Podcast Network on Patreon by going to patreon.com/fwpodcasts. Power of Fishnets is not affiliated with DC Comics, and the views expressed in the show belong solely to the speaker. All music, audio clips, and quoted text are used for entertainment purposes and believed covered under fair use, and no copyright infringement is intended. Thank you for listening.
Oh, if I hold my breath until I die, I'll be all right.